The following is a repeat broadcast of Health Matters, and no phone calls will be taken tonight.
Hello, I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio. This is the time of year when we are constantly aware of the many insects that also inhabit our environment. Unfortunately, some of these neighbors can cause health problems. Tonight, we will discuss some local insects that can have some serious health consequences if we are not smart about our encounters with them. So tonight, we're talking about insect-borne diseases. With us tonight, we have two excellent guests. We have Dr. Joseph Bocchini, a pediatric infectious disease specialist, also the chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at LSU here in Shreveport School of Medicine, as well as Dr. Beverly Burden. She is an associate professor of biology here at Louisiana State University School of Medicine in Shreveport, and she is an entomologist. And you probably have heard Dr. Burden on the air before here at Red River Radio. She is a regular guest on the show, What's Bugging You? And so tonight, Dr. Bocchini, what's bugging us are insects that can cause health problems. Thank you so much, and welcome back to Health Matters.
Well, thank you for inviting me back. I think the most important insects that we worry about right now are mosquitoes and ticks. And we worry about them because mosquitoes can transmit a number of very serious infections that can cause significant illness, neurologic illness, meningitis, encephalitis. And ticks can cause some illnesses that can lead to serious infections as well, and even death. So it's very important, as we discuss this, to talk about how do we prevent those illnesses from happening.
So obviously prevention is the key. You don't want to get the infection and have to go through the treatment. In general, we'll talk about how to prevent these diseases, how to treat them once they do occur. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. The number for your calls for comments and questions tonight is 1-800-552-8502. I'm your host, Dr. Randall Brewer. And our other guest tonight is Dr. Beverly Burden. Dr. Burden, welcome to Health Matters. You're wearing another hat tonight, so we really appreciate you crossing over, cross-fertilizing our show tonight. Tell us, in terms of the insects that are the biggest problem right now, what are their characteristics in terms of what's important for humans to know to prevent their encounters with them?
Well, as Dr. Bocchini said, we're very concerned about mosquitoes this time of year, especially with all the flooding that the area has had over the last month and a half. And the mosquitoes, the problem with them is that there are some that bite in the morning, there's some that bite during the day, and then there's some that bite from dusk to dawn. And so it's important to realize that you're susceptible to mosquito bites 24 hours a day. And, of course, we're going to talk a little bit later about staying indoors and what kind of clothes to wear and such.
So mosquitoes, there are different types of mosquitoes. What are the most common mosquitoes that we have, and are those mosquitoes that actually carry diseases?
There are actually 68 species of mosquitoes in the listening area that we have today, but there's only a small handful of those that will actually and can actually transmit some of the diseases we'll be discussing. The first one is unique. It's called the Asian tiger mosquito, and it was introduced into the United States in 1985. And out of the 4 to 5 species, it's the only one that's not a native species that's been introduced. It's a very large black mosquito with white marks on the legs and a white stripe right down. It's what we would call the back or the thorax. Another one is also in the Aedes family. This is Aedes aegypti. And oftentimes, this is referred to as the yellow fever mosquito, but it can transmit dengue fever, as Dr. Bocchini and I were discussing before the show went on. And it's also black, but it's much smaller, and it has a white, not a white stripe down the back, but a white bar down the back. And then you have the anopheles. And that's the thing. There's only about 3 different genus or genera or mosquitoes in the that we're concerned about. There's the Aedes, there are Anopheles, which is also known as the malaria mosquito, but it can also transmit West Nile. It's a large brown mosquito. And then we have what we call the southern house mosquito. It's in the genus Culex. And there's several species, but namely Culex pipens around this area. And it's a very small, almost yellowish type of mosquito, well known to be a transmitter of West Nile. So those are the four big ones that we're concerned about.
Now, in terms of mosquito protection, you mentioned staying mm-hmm. indoors. What other recommendations would you have in terms of, you know, it's tough to stay indoors when it's nice outside.
Especially
early in the morning and later in the evening when the temperatures come down. That's when we want to be outside.
So exactly.
How do we get outside safely?
Two things. One, wearing the proper clothes. I know it's not comfortable to wear pants and long sleeves, but that does have some protection. I'm a very large proponent of insect repellents. And there are basically three different types of insect repellents that I recommend. One, of course, is the DEET, diethylamide, diethylamide, actually. And it's a very strong repellent. There's another one that the CDC recognizes, and outside of DEET, and that's the Pecarine. I believe that's how you pronounce that. And it is actually a derivative of the pepper plant. And it's supposed to have a little bit more of a stronger repellent than DEET, but you have to apply it more often. And then there are plant oils like citronella, lemon, eucalyptus oils that the CDC does. Those are the three ones that the CDC recommends. Those are the three ones that I would also recommend. And, of course, just being smart and applying it regularly. You can get DEET at different concentrations, and it doesn't mean that 10% is half as good as 20%. It's just that 20% lasts twice as long as 10%. So that's when they read those percentages, they can know that.
And we'll talk about perhaps the comparative efficacy, if you will, of these various preventive measures as we go through the show.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
This is Health Matters, a live show where we invite you to join our discussion. Dr. Joseph Bocchini, professor and chairman of pediatrics here at Louisiana State University School of Medicine in Shreveport. He is also an infectious disease specialist in the pediatric population, as well as Dr. Beverly Burden. She is associate professor of biology here at Louisiana State University School of
at Shreveport.
Louisiana State University in Shreveport. Okay, Dr. Bocchini, if you counsel your children that you see in terms of preventing mosquito bites, we talked about the insect repellents and we talked about wearing protective clothing. What are your recommendations in terms of if the kids get bitten and they have a lot of mosquito bites? I know that can cause parents quite a bit of worry, and I understand that. Is it actually common to be bitten several times before you actually are aware that mosquitoes are around?
It's not unusual for a child to be very busy doing a number of things outside and not really recognize that they're being bitten. And if they are in an area where there are a large number of mosquitoes, they can get multiple bites before they really recognize it. And just scratching a little bit, they just keep doing what they're doing. So the goal, as Dr. Burden said, is to do our best to try and prevent those bites from happening. If they do, most children are going to have a mild area of swelling and discoloration. It will last for a number of days. Some children, especially young children, get a very large reaction when they get bitten. Parents don't need to worry about that. It's still a very local reaction, and usually within 24 hours, it starts looking like a pretty normal reaction. If there's a significant amount of itching related to it, then the simple thing to do is to try and cover the area with calamine lotion. That usually is all that you need to do. If there's more itching and it's multiple bites, I think a parent can call their physician and determine whether it would be appropriate for the child to get an antihistamine, such as Benadryl, to help control the itching that let the child rest or sleep. But for most mosquito bites, that's all you really need to do is to do local care, and they'll resolve without any difficulty.
Dr. Burden, you know, a number of things have been talked about in terms of attractiveness by a mosquito. And it's not uncommon to be out with a group of people, and one individual will say, I've got to get out of here. The mosquitoes are killing me. And somebody else says, mosquitoes? Where's the mosquitoes? And so are people different in terms of the attractiveness that they have by mosquitoes?
Absolutely. And that is a perfect portrayal of what you just said. Mosquitoes are attracted by body chemicals and by CO2. And so the body chemicals are what's going to be different from one individual to the next.
And are there certain things that can be done in terms of, I don't know if there are particular diets or particular colognes or anything that someone can do with their personal hygiene that will deter mosquitoes? I've never heard of anything along those lines outside of the repellents.
The situation with the colognes, as far as I know, there's no diet that is going to change these odors, the natural production of chemicals from the skin. And the problem with colognes is sometimes it may mask these smells, but there's still the CO2 attraction that's going to be able to bring them in. And so that's that.
Dr. Bocchini, when we're talking about prevention, and if we're going to put a compound on a child to prevent them from getting mosquito bites, are there risks of the repellents themselves that parents should be aware of?
Well, outside
of, you know, ingestion, obviously.
Yeah, I think the DEET is very clearly, it's been here for many years. And the evidence is that if it's applied based on manufacturer recommendations, even at the 30% concentration, it's very safe. So we have a long record of using that in multiple situations where it's clearly a safe compound. I think the important thing for parents is that they need to apply it properly. And so DEET should be applied to clothing and just exposed areas of the skin. So we don't need to cover the entire body. We need to cover the clothing and then exposed areas of the skin. Very importantly, it should not be sprayed on the face because you do want to avoid it getting on mucous membranes in the mouth or in the eyes. And so for the face, parents should spray a little bit in their hands and then apply it to the face of a child. And actually, young children should not be allowed to apply their own DEET. The parent should apply the DEET to the child. And so I think if parents follow those precautions, then they can be used very safely. In addition, as Dr. Burton said, the concentration of DEET is very important in terms of the duration of protection it might provide. And so if families are going to be outside for long periods of time or they're swimming, that's also going to shorten the effectiveness of the compound. They need to be aware that they need to reapply the DEET as needed to keep the protection over time.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio, and our topic tonight is mosquito-borne illnesses. Kevin from Zavala, Texas. Kevin, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
I have a question about the attractiveness issue with mosquitoes. I grew up on the Texas Gulf Coast, and I live in the Piney Woods on the lake, and I left Texas for 20 years because of mosquitoes. I really hated them so much, and they've been after me all my life. So I'm 50 years old, and this year I don't think I have been bitten the first time. What might have changed in my body chemistry? I mean, it seems like a pretty drastic change from being bombarded my whole life until this year when they're just not biting me. I'm kind of curious about that.
Kevin, where did you move to?
Well, first Denver, then California, then New York, and then back here. And I was gone for 21 years, you know.
And how long?
And the Hudson Valley is no better than the Texas Gulf Coast for mosquitoes, but, you know.
How long have you been back?
I've been back for 5 or 6 years.
Dr. Burton, do you know of anything that could have happened to Kevin to reduce his attractiveness by mosquitoes?
I think he just got lucky this year.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a lot of weather fluctuations, and that might influence it as well.
Now, is there a differential attractivity according to the population of mosquitoes? Is it possible that some individuals may be in one part of the country where there's a heavy population of mosquitoes that may be attracted to their scents, and then move to a different part of the country where there may be a different population of mosquitoes that just doesn't particularly like an individual? Is that possible?
It is possible that there may be different species. And some mosquitoes are a little bit more aggressive than the others. The Aedes mosquitoes tend to be less aggressive than the Culex mosquitoes. And so that might be a factor. And the aggressiveness of the mosquitoes, it also may be that his chemistry has changed. I mean, 20 years, a lot can go on. You know, so we would have to really turn that over to an MD and get a full history.
Sure. This is listener-supported Red River Radio. This is Health Matters. Our topic tonight, mosquito-borne illnesses and other insect illnesses as well. Our guest tonight, Dr. Joseph Bocchini. He is professor of pediatrics here at Louisiana State University School of Medicine, Shreveport. And Dr. Beverly Burden. She is associate professor of biology here at Louisiana State University in Shreveport. So, Dr. Bocchini, we talked about some mosquito-borne illnesses, or you briefly mentioned a few at the beginning of the show. What symptoms should a parent be concerned about in a child that's been bitten by mosquitoes that could hint to the onset of one of these illnesses?
So the most important or most common mosquito-borne viral infection that we're seeing in the United States today, and particularly in Louisiana, is West Nile virus. And this is a virus that can infect both children and adults. It's more severe in adults than it is in children. But amongst the individuals who are infected, probably 99 out of 100 never know they're infected because the majority of infections have no symptoms. So about 90% have absolutely no symptoms. About 10% have a illness that's characterized by fever. It's characterized by joint and muscle pain, and frequently with a rash. And we call that West Nile fever. It may last for a few days, but then it resolves completely. Occasionally, a child or an adult will have a significant headache with that, but it'll resolve. The cases we most worry about are that last 1% or just less than 1%. Here, the virus gets into the central nervous system and can cause meningitis and encephalitis. And encephalitis is a severe infection that involves the brain that can result in seizures, can result in change in mental status, can result in change in your ability to utilize your muscles effectively. And as I mentioned, this becomes more frequent in adults and more severe. So if you're over 50 and develop West Nile central nervous system infection, you have a much greater chance of developing severe disease and what we call sequelae, that when you recover, you have abnormal findings. And occasionally, there can be a death associated with West Nile. So subsequent to a mosquito bite, if in the next week a child develops a fever and the symptoms I mentioned, West Nile should be in the differential diagnosis.
So the incubation period is about a week or so?
About a week.
Okay.
And it may be a few days shorter than that and a few days longer than that.
Okay, we have Woody from Lufkin. Woody, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight. What's your question?
Well, it's not a question as much as it is a comment. When it comes to diets for mosquitoes, years and years ago, I found a product that was sold through, classified ads, whatever, in some of the outdoor magazines. And it turned out, after I did some research, that it's just thiamine hydrochloride, vitamin B1. And I have discovered after playing with it, if I take a couple of 100 milligrams of it about an hour before I go outside, the skin emits the odor, and the mosquitoes stay away from me. Otherwise, I get swamped. So just for what it's worth, plain old vitamin B1 in a sufficient quantity, like 100 milligrams or so, seems to keep them off of me. And that's because it does emit odors from the skin.
So Woody, you take it prophylactically, not routinely. Is that correct?
Correct.
Interesting. Dr. Bocchini, have you heard of B1 as a prophylaxis for mosquito exposure?
Yes, people have used vitamin B1 for a number of years to try and prevent mosquito bites, and Woody has a good experience with it, but in general, the studies that have been done looking at its effectiveness have shown that it has very limited effectiveness, if any at all, in larger populations.
Right.
So there may be an individual difference, but for the most part, it's not been proven to be effective. Other people have used garlic. That's also not been proven to be effective. Other people have used bananas, and that's not been proven effective either.
Garlic may keep the people away, though.
Well, they were the vampires.
Also, we have Shannon from Houston. Shannon, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir, for taking my call. What I was concerned about is I have a dog that's in the backyard, and I was concerned about the mosquitoes. What kind of effect would they have on him if they was to have actually bite him or attack him?
Dr. Burden, animals and mosquitoes, good question.
I think the biggest concern about any pet, a dog or a cat, is the transmission of heartworms. And that's easily taken care of. In fact, I went to my veterinary today and got another supply of heartworm, a monthly pill that you can give to them. I wouldn't recommend what they would call dips anymore. Those have not been as effective as the oral medication to control heartworms.
Yes, sir. My next question, I just have one thing. What's that repellent called? DEEP? What is it called?
Yes, it's DEET.
Okay. All right. Thank you all for taking my call. Y'all have a blessed day.
Okay. Thank you, Shannon.
You're welcome.
Pamela from Shreveport, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hello.
Hi, Pamela.
How are you?
We're good.
Good. I don't really have a question, but I've always had a tremendous problem with being bitten by mosquitoes, and I'm allergic to most insecticide, well, pretty much any insecticide and chemicals and things like that. And so it's always been hard for me to prevent being bitten. I just wanted to say that for the first time this year, I tried one of those traps that produces CO2 and then pulls them into, they're attracted to that, and it pulls them into a trap with a fan. And I got one to cover an acre because that's what I have, and it has made a huge difference.
Thank you for sharing that. When you say you're allergic to the insecticide, what do you mean? What's your allergic reaction?
I have asthma really badly.
Okay.
And I'll end up with a respiratory infection when I'm exposed.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that. Dr. Burden, what's the data on the mosquito traps? In terms of
the mosquito
efficacy.
Traps that she described does have some efficacy involved with that by just sheer reducing the quantity of mosquitoes that's in the area. There's also been some systems where they're misting pyrethrins in local areas, and that is an adulticide, and that will take care of the adults. For the larvicides, in fact, maybe I should just go through the life cycle of a mosquito real quick. In this area, most mosquitoes overwinter as eggs. And you can't really, there's nothing that we know of on how to treat eggs because different mosquitoes lay their eggs different ways. Some leave them in water, some lay them in areas that will be flooded and so forth. So once the egg hatches, the larvae are aquatic and they will feed on algae and other organic matter that's there in the environment. And the larvae will go through about four molts before it becomes a pupa. And ironically, the pupa of mosquitoes are actually active as well. They don't feed, but they do exist in the water, and they're called tumblers, and they'll tumble up and they'll tumble down. And then from there, the mosquito hatches into an adult. And the life cycle at this time of the year is approximately 7 days. So most people say don't let standing water occur in your yard beyond 7 days or 2 7 days. And then once the adults hatch, it's actually only the female mosquito that takes the blood meal. The male part of the mosquito does not take a blood meal, and they basically consume nectar. And then the female mosquito will lay eggs, and a single female mosquito will lay a component of eggs. This can be anywhere from 100 to 150 eggs at a time. And then And she will not take another blood meal until that clutch of eggs are laid. But people also have to realize when we're talking about infectious diseases, that's the life cycle of the mosquito, but we also have the life cycle of the pathogen, either the virus or the protozoan or the bacteria. And that's very interesting, too. And if we need to come back to that, I'll be glad to. That also explains why not all mosquitoes can carry the pathogens.
Very interesting.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio, and our show tonight is Health Matters. Our guest tonight, Dr. Beverly Burden. She is Associate Professor of Biology here at Louisiana State University in Shreveport, as well as Professor and Chair of Pediatrics here at Louisiana State University School of Medicine in Shreveport, Dr. Joseph Bocchini, an infectious disease expert as well. Dr. Bocchini, we were talking about West Nile virus and the symptoms that parents should look out for if their kids have been bitten by mosquitoes. Once you've made the diagnosis, perhaps you can tell us how you make the diagnosis, if it's a blood test or a spinal fluid test, and how is it treated in the more severe cases?
Well, unfortunately, there is no specific medical treatment to counteract the viral infection, so we provide supportive care. The diagnosis is made by taking blood from the patient and looking for either the remnants of the virus, the genetic material of the virus, or looking for an antibody response against the virus. In cases of patients who have central nervous system infection, we will look at spinal fluid and do similar tests on spinal fluid. So the most important thing for us to do when we have a patient is to provide them with supportive care, manage the complications of the illness to try and prevent further damage that might be done by the complications. But it's really only when the host's immune system begins to develop its own protection will the virus be eradicated and symptoms resolve.
You know, Dr. Burden, as we know from the infamous disease Ebola, we can travel to other places and get bitten by mosquitoes or get exposed to other pathogens and bring those back to our country. And we were discussing before the show, there's some viral diseases that can be transmitted by mosquitoes when we go on vacation, perhaps in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about that virus that we were discussing?
Yeah. It's called the chikungunya virus, and it is now in the Caribbean. But the scary problem with that is the mosquitoes that I talked about before, the mosquito that will cause West Nile virus, the Aedes albopictus, the Aedes aegypti, and the Anopheles mosquitoes can all transmit the chikungunya virus. So it's only a matter of time before it's going to be established within the North America up into the more temperate areas.
As an indolent.
It's coming. It's not if, it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, the last year there were over 800 cases of chikungunya virus diagnosed in the United States amongst travelers who had gone to the Caribbean or to Asian countries where this virus is prevalent. So one of the problems with this viral infection as opposed to West Nile is that people who are infected have high titers of virus in their blood for many days. So it makes the subsequent mosquito bite very likely to next mosquito to become infected. So the chance that a population can begin to experience an outbreak is pretty high. So I think Dr. Burden is right that there is a reasonable chance that we will see transmission of this virus in the United States. There's already been a very small outbreak of chikungunya infection with transmission in Florida, so that we know that it's very possible it could happen. In fact, West Nile was introduced in this country for the first time in 1999. It was never in the Western Hemisphere until 1999. The first cases were in New York, and the virus was capable of then spreading across the entire United States within just a few years.
So what happens if a patient, let's say they're incubating the virus and they get bitten by another mosquito and they basically pass it from human to mosquito and back to human again?
That's correct.
But there's also a timeline that has to be realized there. And this is what I was referring to before as the life cycle of the potential pathogen. When a mosquito feeds, She is injecting hypodermic needles, like two hypodermic needles, into your skin. In one, she's sucking out the blood, and in the other, she's injecting her saliva. And so when she feeds on an individual that is infected with the virus or the bacteria, that is taken into her gut and has to be able to pass from her gut into her, what we call lymphatic system, not a lymphatic system as we know it by humans, but we just call it the lymph. Insects don't have veins and arteries. Their blood just sloshes around in their body. And so it has to go from the gut to the sloshing blood back up to her salivary glands. And so that's a very complex thing that a virus has to do. And that takes time. So if bit human number A at 7 o'clock and they went over and bit human number B at 7:30, that timeline will not have, won't be enough time for that cycle to complete itself.
So Dr. Bocchini, so chikungunya is more of an epidemic phenomenon as opposed to perhaps West Nile being more of an endemic phenomenon, or is
That's
chikungunya
correct.
endemic in the Caribbean as well? Is it something that we see every year at some level, or is it something that occurs only during epidemics?
Well, again, there had never been a case of chikungunya in the Western Hemisphere until, I think, 2013, and there was a single case and then an outbreak on one of the Caribbean islands, and it has spread from there across the entire Caribbean and parts of Central and South America. So, and it does, when it gets into a population, will infect 30 to 50% of the population. So it is more of an epidemic when it occurs.
Now, is this a virus that the population becomes relatively resistant or immune to, and travelers are more prone to become symptomatic if they get the virus?
Yeah, travelers
sort of like
would,
malaria, right?
Yes, because they are experiencing their first episode. They're going to get the classic symptoms. And actually, chikungunya is characterized by severe joint pains, severe arthritis. And so people with chikungunya will have fever, joint and muscle pains, but it's the joint pains and discomfort, the arthritis, that is really the remarkable feature of this illness, which can last for many months following the recuperation, during the recuperation period.
And chronic pain as well, I believe, similar to Lyme disease, it can
Correct.
Cause chronic joint pain.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. Our topic tonight, insect-borne diseases, mosquitoes and ticks and the like. Let's play a public service announcement from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, about Lyme disease.
Spring and summer are prime time for ticks that can spread Lyme disease and other infections. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would like to remind you to wear bug repellent when outdoors, shower as soon as possible after coming indoors, and check your whole body for ticks every day. If you've been bitten by a tick and develop fever, rash, or fatigue, seek medical care. To learn more, visit www.cdc.gov/Lyme.
You know, the CDC website is excellent for just about any sort of medical information, and this public service announcement, I think, reminds us that, you know, Lyme disease isn't common, but ticks are common in Louisiana. What do you see as the major issues with tick-borne illnesses here in our region, Dr. Bocchini?
The most common tick-borne illnesses that we see are caused by a group of pathogens called rickettsia. They cause Rocky Mountain spotted fever. They cause ehrlichiosis. They cause anaplasmosis. So these are three different syndromes that have very similar manifestations, the most severe of which is Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which can have up to a 10% mortality rate. They usually start off with fever, again, muscle pain, often with headache, mild conjunctivitis, redness of the eyes. And that worsens over a couple of days, and then they break out in a rash. And that rash is very characteristic in that it starts off on the palms and the soles and the wrists and the ankles, then it spreads centrally. Very characteristic rash of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. It needs to be treated with an antibiotic. The antibiotic is doxycycline. And early treatment is very effective in eliminating this disease and also is appropriate therapy for the Ehrlichia and anaplasma infections as well. So these are really important diseases. They are transmitted with the tick bite, but again, the tick needs to be on the person and for a significant period of time before the transmission is really occurs effectively. So like mosquitoes, the best way to prevent these diseases is to prevent a bite from a tick. And that's why I think the CDC recommendations are very appropriate. If you're going to be outdoors in an area where there may be ticks, you need to be sure that you check all areas of your body when you come in from being outside. You could use, again, an insecticide or an insect repellent to reduce the likelihood of being exposed to the ticks.
Dr. Burden, what are ticks and why do they exist, and where do we get ticks from? What areas are ticks?
Ticks are very similar to spiders in the fact that they have some of the similar mouth parts that spiders do, but they don't have fangs. Of course, one of the things that they do have in common with spiders is that they have 8 legs, unless they're what we call the seed ticks, and they have only 6 legs, but then when they molt and mature, they'll get to have 8 legs. Why they exist? Well, that brings us into
existential question.
Yes, but let me talk a little.
I meant to ask you that about mosquitoes, so maybe we can ponder both at some point.
But the bite of a tick is very different than the bite of a mosquito. When the tick bites, it has a specialized mouth part called a hypostome, and it actually has recurved bars on it. And so when they insert that mouth part that's going to feed on the blood, that it's very hard to pull the tick out because it has these recurved bars on it. And so you also have to be very, very careful about how you remove the tick. Also, unlike the mosquitoes, both the males and the females will take blood meals, but the females need a much more voluminous blood meal. She will actually swell up and engorge, where the males won't, not because they don't take so much blood, but because they have a shield across their back that prevents them from swelling. It's almost like some type of weight loss programs. They just can't take very much in. But the interesting thing that I always find about ticks versus mosquitoes is that mosquitoes tend to transmit more infectious diseases concerning viruses, but with ticks, as Dr. Bocchini said, it's more bacterial, rickettsia and Ehrlichia, along those lines. And as he said, they have to feed for quite some time. Mm-hmm.
So it's a dose-related phenomenon in terms of the amount of bacteria that goes from the tick into the human.
And it's a time phenomenon well. It takes a fair amount of time for the contamination to occur that leads to the transmission to the organism.
There's another interesting part of the biology of ticks that a lot of people don't understand, is ticks are very, they don't fly around. They don't have wings like mosquitoes do. And so what ticks will do is they will crawl up a tall piece of grass, and they will hang upside down with their front legs swaying in the air. This is a process that we call questing. And they actually have CO2 sensors at the end of their front legs. And whenever they sense an increase in CO2, they will just hop into that direction, turn loose, and that's how they find people. One of the common things that I tell many people to do, if they want to kind of survey a certain area, a campground, if there's a tick situation there, take a white piece of cloth and drag it behind them, because as they're exhaling CO2, the ticks will jump onto the white cloth, and a tick on a white cloth is very easy to see. Another classic example, this is a little bit more research scientific, but you can pull a piece of dry ice along, and they'll jump onto that piece of dry ice, and of course that's instant death to a tick.
So does tick density vary in different parts of the woodlands?
Absolutely. It has to have the right habitat. Normally it is woodland and it is tall grass, and so you have to be very careful with that.
Now, the types of ticks that bite our pets, are those going to be the same types of ticks that can give us your tick-borne illnesses?
Absolutely. Ticks are not host-specific, nor are mosquitoes host-specific. Mosquitoes will basically bite any mammal and birds. Ticks, there's two groups of ticks. There's those ticks that feed on birds. Those are called the soft ticks. Then you have the ticks that feed on mammals. Those are called the hard ticks because they have a back shield. And what is very host-specific that can transmit diseases are lice. We have three different types of lice that exist in our body, our head lice, our pubic lice, and our body lice, and it's only the body lice that can transmit typhus.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio, and we're talking about insect-borne diseases.
So just to add a little bit about prevention of tick bites, I think it's really important that when you have animals, especially dogs, that they are cared for in such a way that they get tick preventive treatment during the summer, because one of the risk factors for exposure to ticks in children is being around the family dog. So going out camping and as Dr. Burton said, in areas that were low brush and tall grass, those would be the classic areas. So if you're going to do that, again, you need to be covered. And so the recommendation is long sleeves and long pants. Tuck the pants into your socks to try and reduce the risk of exposure. And then use a repellent on your clothing because the repellent will prevent the tick from being hopping on. They really avoid the repellent. And in this case, DEET is not the best repellent. It's permethrin, and that's the one that people would recommend using to prevent tick exposure.
In the clothes as well as on the skin?
On the clothes, not on the skin.
On the clothes, not on the skin. Right. And now, do these ticks present a risk to hunters as well? Because it can still be quite warm, you know, when hunting season starts. Squirrel hunting starts, I think, in October. You know, it's still in the 80s in November, typically here, very commonly anyway.
Yes.
So hunters are at risk as well.
Yes, they are.
Okay, Dr. Burton, you mentioned that a number of, getting back to insecticides a little bit, a number of quote-unquote natural options were available. Can we get back to a little bit of the comparative efficacy of those? Because, you know, people use citronella candles, and you mentioned the eucalyptus. Are these as effective as DEET and permethrin? Are they natural alternatives that will work just as well?
Well, permethrin really isn't a repellent. It's actually classified as an insecticide. And we've been using DEET for a long, long time, and we know it works. My question is, why haven't resistance been built up against DEET after this long, long exposure of use? Now, the more botanical areas like the lemon, eucalyptus oils, they don't work as well as DEET does, but they certainly are an alternative. The citronella candles, of course, just basically put the citronella mist in the air and it acts as a repellent. When the mosquitoes come into contact with that, they just don't pursue it any longer. Mosquitoes, when they're flying about, what they're looking for, what the female mosquitoes, their chemosensory organs are monitoring at all time is concentration of the body odors and the CO2, and they'll fly zigzag patterns until they find a steady stream of that, and then they'll orientate their flight in that direction. Another thing about mosquitoes finding people and biting them is that many mosquitoes don't have a large flying range. The mosquitoes that bite you in your yard more likely developed its life cycle in your yard or your neighbor's yard. And so that's why it's so important to make sure that all standing water containers are emptied. If you don't empty a standing water container, perhaps you have a pond, then you have to use what we call mosquito dunks. They are, they will slow release an insecticide called Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis toxin. It comes from a bacteria, Bacillus thuringiensis, and it is a good larval side. And so if you're going to have standing water, treat it with the BT mosquito dunks.
Now, is that something that's recommended that folks put in their pools?
Yeah. No, no, not necessarily pools, although there's no mammalian toxicity. It is very specific to insects. In fact, there's different strains of the bacillus, but the BTI is the one that's for mosquitoes. There's one for beetles, and then there's also one for caterpillars.
And our current swimming pool agents don't necessarily breed mosquitoes. It's only standing water that's fresh water that's not salinated or chlorinated, correct?
In most of the time, it's standing water that exists over 7 days. But there are mosquitoes that lay their eggs in fresh water, as I mean to be not salt water, okay? Bayous, lakes, ponds, they'll lay their eggs there as well. And so swimming pools nowadays are either heavily chlorinated, but you don't remain submerged all the time when you're in a swimming pool, so you're still exposing your skin to the bite of mosquito, or the swimming pools are now salt water, and that's a deterrent for mosquitoes as well. Their eggs won't develop in salt water.
The patient information website for the Mayo Clinic listed these standing water hazards for our listeners to be reminded of. Unclog roof gutters, empty children's wading pools at least once a week, preferably more often because those are not salinated or chlorinated. Change water in birth baths at least weekly. Get rid of old tires. Empty outdoor flower pots regularly or store them upside down so that they can't collect water. And drain your fire pit. We don't live in Minnesota. I think there are probably a lot more fire pits up there in Minnesota than there are here. But, you know, that's, you know, good points. There are probably sources of water that can be hidden that people don't think about. And so if they're getting bit by mosquitoes pretty often, they might want to look around for that standing water, because you're saying that the mosquito that bit you probably lives pretty close to you.
There's ironically, there's a mosquito that's called the tree hole mosquito. And so if you have a tree that has holes in it, knots in it, where any water can stand, that's also a very hidden source that many people may not realize.
And with the flooding, it's nearly impossible to avoid the standing water here in North Louisiana these days. Dr. Bocchini, a listener, has asked a question that if someone has had West Nile previously, can they get it again? So is there any immunity based on exposure?
We think that once you've had West Nile infection, that you do have immunity that protects you from a second infection.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
And this is listener-supported Red River Radio, and the topic tonight, insect-borne diseases. Our guest tonight, Dr. Joseph Bocchini, he is chairman of pediatrics here at Louisiana State University School of Medicine in Shreveport, as well as he is a pediatric infectious disease specialist. And Dr. Beverly Burden is here with us. She's often here for What's Bugging You. She is an associate professor of biology here at Louisiana State University in Shreveport. So you mentioned lice as another potential bug that can be in our environment. Dr. Burden, wasps and bees can be pretty common this time of year as well. Any recommendations that you could have with your listeners in terms of being aware of where they may be harboring those harmful insects as well?
Wasps are very interesting because you have wasps that are solitary, and this applies to bees as well, that don't live in nests. And then you have wasps that are colonial. They live in colonies. And what I would tell the listening audience is most of the time the wasps that are going to attack people are ones that are in colonies, and it's when their colony has been disturbed. And so if you see a bunch of wasps flying around an area, you need to investigate that area and see if there might be a nest in that location. If there is a nest in that location, and if you want to call in experts, that they'll take care of it. But what most people do is they just get the insecticide spray that sprays 27 feet, you know, and they stand back and they just douse it good. If that's what the listening audience wants to do, I recommend that they go out early in the morning or later at night when most of the colony is back on the nest, and that way you get as they say, a bigger bang for your buck. You get a higher ratio kill, and they won't return to that area to make another nest. And most wasps are not going to be totally aggressive unless they're disturbed. So if you see a wasp, a hornet, don't run down the street screaming. Just kind of back away. And they're very attracted to reds and yellows. And I notice that when I'm wearing those two colors, I seem to get more wasps flying around me. And just don't panic, and they'll be fine. And, of course, there are some people that Dr. Bikini can address this that are hypersensitive to wasp stings and to bee stings. And if that's the case, then they need to be even more cautious.
Hypervigilant, yep. We have a caller. We have John from Shreveport. John, thanks for calling us tonight.
So I was wondering about the vaccine for West Nile virus and whether I should give it to my prize racehorse.
I can address that. That's a very good point. West Nile virus, there is a vaccine for horses. They are working on a vaccine for humans, I understand. But that's kind of ironic that we have a vaccine for horses and not for people yet. But as we know, there are a lot of pathogens that are established in animals, zoonosis, that can then jump from people like the West Nile virus did from birds to humans. The Ehrlichia that was originally thought to be only in deer and Ehrlichiosis in humans didn't really come about until what? Maybe the late 1980s, early 1990s?
1990s.
Yeah. So that is a very new, actually emerging, because it jumped from animals to humans. And if I had a prize racehorse, I would definitely give them the West Nile virus vaccine.
Are there any other vaccines that we should use in our prize racehorses, like an Eastern equine virus?
That I can't answer. I'm not a veterinarian. I'm an entomologist. But so check with your veterinarian and see what they have to say, and they'll be more versed on that than I am. Very excellent question, though.
All right. Thank you.
John, thank you so much for calling. Dr. Bocchini, John mentioned Eastern equine encephalitis, and there's also Western, and there's Venezuelan. Mm-hmm. Do we see those infections in people here in our region?
We occasionally see Eastern equine encephalitis. It's usually subsequent to an outbreak in horses. The Eastern equine encephalitis virus is an arbovirus. West Nile is another arbovirus, and there are many different arboviruses that can be transmitted by mosquitoes. In Louisiana, we have occasional Eastern equine. We have occasional outbreaks of St. Louis encephalitis and occasional outbreaks of La Crosse. There's a series. Arboviruses are named from where they're first found. And so we occasionally will have small outbreaks of these other arboviruses. Again, all mosquito-borne. The same rules apply as to try and prevent infection by preventing mosquito bites.
Preventing mosquito bites, that's one major topic of tonight's discussion, as well as preventing tick bites. It is that season of the year. We have just a few more minutes to take calls if you have a question or a comment to make. One thing we had mentioned, Dr. Bocchini, was ticks tend to harbor bacteria, and mosquitoes tend to harbor viruses. But just going through some of the issues, other issues with ticks, do we see any of the viruses such as Colorado tick fever or any of the flaviviruses that can potentially come from ticks? Do we see that much here in our area?
Not in our area, but we do see a bacterial infection. We see tularemia. It's not the most common way tularemia is transmitted, but it can be transmitted by a tick bite. That's a bacterial infection, can be pretty severe. And again, the history of a tick bite with a person with a febrile illness who has fever and other symptoms would lead us to consider tularemia in the differential diagnosis.
Okay, tularemia, and how is that treated?
It's treated, again, with an antibiotic. We typically use an aminoglycoside, gentamicin, that is highly effective in managing that infection. In milder infections, we'll use doxycycline.
And we have to mention Lyme disease as well. And that's a very important tick-borne illness. None of it has been established in the Louisiana area, but it's certainly in Arkansas and many of the surrounding states. And, of course, Dr. Bocchini would tell you that one of the classic symptoms is the bullseye rash.
Right.
And that can also be treated, if I'm not speaking out of place, with broad-spectrum antibiotics.
Yes, and for a child, we would use ampicillin. For mm-hmm. an adult, they would use doxycycline.
Right.
But it's true that that's a important diagnostic feature, this classic bullseye-type rash that occurs.
Let's try to get to the last couple of calls here. We have Chuck from Marshall. Chuck, thanks for calling Health Matters tonight. What's your question?
Yes, I'm a land surveyor, and I got in on this kind of late. So I deal with ticks pretty regular. I was wondering what their advice was for somebody that's in the woods all day, every day, to keep the ticks off of them.
Okay, Chuck. Dr. Burden?
Yeah.
Easy one.
Chuck, easy one. Tuck your pants legs into your socks. Wear DEET. You can apply pyrethrin to your clothing areas, DEET to your skin. And once you get home, self-check and self-examine to make sure you take all the ticks off in a very quick manner.
Okay. That pyrethrin that you're talking about, is that something that I can pick up at a local grocery store, or is that a feed store product, or what?
There are many different types of pyrethrins. Go to any store and look at the active ingredients. If it ends in the suffix, T-H-R-I-N, it is a pyrethrin.
Chuck, thank you so much. We have another caller. Thanks for calling Health Matters tonight. What's your question?
Okay, my name is Melinda.
Thanks, Melinda. I didn't get your name. Sorry about that. What's your question?
I'm from Percy, Texas. And the question I have is, do you have to shower before you go to bed after using DEET?
Thanks, Melinda.
I think that would be an excellent practice to have, but I'm going to throw this over to Dr. Puccini as well.
No, I would agree with that. I think it's good to wash it off with a shower, especially true for children, because occasionally a child is going to scratch their skin and then touch their eye or touch their mouth, and you don't want them to transmit the whatever remaining amount of the compound is there. So, yes, I think a shower is a really good idea.
Thank you, Dr. Bocchini, and thank you, Dr. Beverly Burden, for joining us as our guests on Health Matters tonight. I'd like to thank all of our callers. The questions were really, really good. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. Consult your physician or healthcare provider for all your health concerns. Health Matters is part of Red River Radio's Community Connection series of outreach programs. Guests on Health Matters are not compensated and are selected by relevance to the topic. No fees are charged for participation. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Help from Wally Derleth and Henry Edwards, as well as Tim Snell, is appreciated tonight. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, the Gables at Spring Lake Gamble Guest Care's Assisted Living Community. Learn more at gambleguestcare.com. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.